Hello, hello. Welcome to the Daily Frame podcast. It comes to you every Friday, of course, courtesy of the Institute of Race Relations and the Big Liberty Show. That's right. I'm your host, Big Daddy Liberty, and I've got a very special... I'm in studio with very special people, let me put it that way, including some new faces. Ironically, who you can't see. That's the... can I call it the beauty of a podcast? But
It's definitely faces for radio.
Guys, remember, Daily Friend is a IRR initiative where we broadcast and put out news, analysis, and opinion. And you can find it, of course, at the Daily Friend website. That's dailyfriend.co.za. as I said, I'm not alone. I'm joined by Sara Gunn, who is the... Editor-in-Chief of the Daily Friend, and of course our new
strategic engagement person.
Basically stakeholder engagement, awesome work, builds the sort of relationships that we are reliant on here at the IRR. Sara, how are you doing?
No, well, thank you, Cicely.
Awesome. And we have, as I said, a new face, Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you very much.
Herman, of course, is one of our new interns here at the IRR, a very capable young man, strong writer. So you can look forward to seeing a lot of Herman's written material on The Daily Friend. Guys, remember, The Daily Friend can be found online at dailyfriend.co.za. And we have a show that we produce that comes out every Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. You can find that either on the IRR YouTube page or, of course, on the Big Daddy Liberty YouTube page. Like, share, and subscribe to that, please. Jam-packed show. Won't be too long, but, there are some things we just want to round up in the week. Guys, I'm going to begin in a very interesting place and a very scary place, to be honest. The National Health Insurance. Now, this is a policy that's being touted by the ANC. Excuse me. There's a policy being touted by the ANC to essentially nationalize healthcare in South Africa and almost create an ESCOM of healthcare, you know, a central bureaucracy that has all hospitals under its control, including private hospitals, and of course the abolishment, effectively, of private medical insurance in this country. For very obvious reasons, and I think anybody even listening to me preface it like this is already worried. Why is this a big problem, Sara?
It's a big problem because, A, it does nothing to actually improve the quality of healthcare. It's an insurance, so it deals with the payment for healthcare. It does not deal with the actual infrastructure or the management of a hospital or any of the purchase of medication or equipment. And secondly, it's never really been costed, but the estimates roughly drawn from people in the private sector is this is so unaffordable as to be impossible.
And, you know, the real concern here, and you're right, you're absolutely right, sorry, the real concern is it seems as though the cabinet, which approved the NHI policy this week, is doing so almost in spite of the evidence that it's not really working. I mean, they ran a pilot project of the NHI, and of the, I think, 12 hospitals, am I stand corrected? Only one of the hospitals sort of barely made it to the requisite standard of what they assume an NHI would bring about. Herman, I'm going to bring you in here because, you know, I was making the point with Sara on the show version of this podcast, that, you know, online, because I made a meal of this week on social media. You know, a lot of people come back and say, they retort and say, well, actually, you know, if you look at the UK, they have the NHS and it works fantastically. And, you know, France's one is really good. You know, and the old favorite for any statist and socialist are the Scandinavians. Yes. They're doing so well. The Canadians, they're doing so well. And then I have to point out to them that actually they're not. Mm-hmm. Yes, at one level, at an emergency level, it works, right? In other words, if you are shot or you're in a car accident, an ambulance will come pick you up.
Or stabbed in London.
A big phenomenon they have now. You know, an ambulance will rock up, it'll pick you up, it'll send you to an emergency unit, and you'll get actually very good quality care in that regard. But the problem comes when you have a illness that needs ongoing, long-term, even specialist treatment, where there's long waiting times for elective surgery. Yeah. Why is the NHS not a good standard to even compare our proposed NHI to?
Well, one of the things that you regularly hear on you know, I think fact-based analysis of the NHS is it's the closest the UK will come to a civic religion. Mm. Every single party always brag about our NHS, but if you actually go look at the data and you go look at, as you say, the more specialised forms of care, not just the emergency care, they actually disappoint on many, many levels. So That's the first thing, is the perception of the NHS being this model of wonder is misplaced. Mm. It's typically politicians too scared to say the brave thing of going, right, folks, this is like most socialist ideas, a nice idea. It sounds good, but it doesn't work, because it's basically the government ending up deciding who gets what in terms of healthcare, and that immediately restricts the patient. And then secondly, it's hell of expensive.
Yeah.
In a first world country like Britain, you might be tempted to fund such a large state program, but their finances are in a different state than ours. I mean, Magashule said the other day about quantitative easing, that this is done in developed countries and developed economies, and that's exactly the point. That's where it can be afforded. Whether it's successful or not, that's another question. And the same goes for something I think like the NHS. It's done in developed countries, yes, because they can afford the folly of it.
Sarah made that point on the show to say, actually, you know, we compare ourselves to these countries that have a massive tax base, which allows their states of socialist politicians, if they are socialist, but definitely statist politicians, to take these decisions upon themselves to say, hey, you know, we'll fund a massive, bulky administration, a bureaucracy, essentially, that dishes out and rations, really, healthcare, which is the point I think Herman was making. Yeah. It's actually the rationing of healthcare. Now,
yes.
Any South African who uses the public health sector right now knows exactly what I mean by that in terms of a rationing of healthcare. You know, whether it's you rocking up early in the morning at a public hospital, so you have to rock up there at like 4, 5 in the morning in order to join the queue.
Many a time without proper transport infrastructure.
Exactly. You rock up there 5 in the morning. And again, I'm speaking from experience here, having grown up in a township called Umlazi in Durban. Now, Umlazi has its own hospital called Prince Mshiyeni. And here's the reality of Mshiyeni. I can have a very sick child. I rock up there at least by 4 or 5 in the morning. There's already a queue of nothing less than 100 plus people. In that queue, staff only sort of rock up at around, you know, the shift change at around maybe 6, 7 or so. The admin staff. Only then do they begin to do the sort of like, you know, getting our patient files, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have this wonderful thing called triaging, which is what I meant by, you know, the rationing of healthcare. So in other words, even though you've been in that line since 4, if a patient comes in at 7 who has a stab wound or something, you know, something very serious, you will wait until the doctors, the available doctors on duty, have treated that person, no matter how long it takes, before they start eating into that line. Therefore, you can spend a whole day at a hospital. Now, here's the problem. Now, I'll put this to you guys very briefly. If you have a society of people who, there's a lot of unemployment, and those who have employment can't afford to be at a hospital for a whole day, for example, like this, it affects your economy, so that any ideas of an NHI, which is just basically slapping on a bureaucracy onto this existing system, is a bit of a bad one, isn't it, Sarah?
Well, the problem is you're slapping on a bureaucracy that is about money going into a system, but you're not fixing the system. And we know that our problem with our hospitals is they're not enough staff, they're not enough qualified staff, there's not good management. They can't order their own drugs and equipment. It all has to go centrally. So often hospitals end up with equipment or stuff they don't need, but they don't end up with the stuff that they do need. These are basic, standard, global managerial issues. As people have often said about these, they're not issues that you throw much money at, but these are the way you improve the ability for people to be properly serviced with health. The NHI is an insurance scheme. Mm. And if you're getting insurance to go to a hospital that's lousy anyway, what's the point of having the money to go to the hospital? And I think the rough calculation of what we'd need to budget for it is about 230 billion rand.
Yeah,
that's insane.
Of course it's insane.
And I think those are the conservative estimates.
Yeah.
I'm gonna shift us along, because I think anybody who's listening is probably now going, okay, we get it. It's a big problem. And, you know, the moral of the story is, any time a politician says, I want to control something on your behest, you know, one should be very, very worried. But now, what do we do, right? So what can be done? Now, we already have a colleague here at the Institute who's written extensively about this. Mm. Her name is Anthea Jeffrey, Dr. Anthea Jeffrey. And guys, just look on the IRR website, look under our policies, and you'll see a lot of work that she's done on this. One of the things we advocate for a lot is that actually you need to place the control and the decision-making back into the hands of the individual. And really, as liberals, we talk a lot about the individual, but really we're a family society. Mm-hmm. Therefore, decision-making should happen at the level of the family, the mother, the father, the uko, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the best way you can do that is by handing them the means, mm-hmm. right? So you could break up the health budget, which I think is in excess of 360 billion last financial year. You could break it up into vouchers for poor people and then let them buy the health insurance. Herman, what do you think about that?
No, I think it's brilliant. The thing is, we're not inexperienced when it comes to governments trying to get resources where they should be. We've seen it with school textbooks. We've seen it with infrastructural development. So the moment you put into the hands of the community the ability to fix their own problems, you create this chain reaction of communal investment and caring. And earlier this year, at the very beginning of this year, there were, I think, three so-called smart schools developed at great cost in Gauteng. And Panyaza Lesufi made a big song and dance about the community should look after these infrastructural developments and so on. And then shortly after, the schools were burgled. And I think part of that becomes a problem that there's no communal investment. There's no, you know, it takes a village if we're going to go on your family idea. Mm. There's no sense of community there to say, we paid for this, we manage this, this is here for us, so we should as a community ensure its success. And I just think on an attitudinal level that undermines the ability of these services to be effective, and a voucher system is a way to address that. Those monies are going to be spent. Let them be spent by people who want them to be spent on themselves.
Mm. Sarah?
I just remember talking of the education system when Panyaza Lesufi introduced iPads or smart pads or whatever they're called for teaching. And I thought, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to be sold. They're going to, one smart teenager is going to sell it to somebody.
And who can blame them?
And the second thing is what's not sold will be stolen, because for the same sort of reason. But the third problem is that effective teaching is not about coming through iPads. It's about dealing with the management of your environment.
It's not a money issue like the NHI.
And if the government could only understand that they could save money and achieve better results, but it seems to be an anathema.
Mm. No, guys, I agree. And I think just maybe as a final thought, and we'll move on. Guys, you can look forward to us writing on this issue. Remember, you can find all our pieces of analysis and our articles on the Daily Friend website at dailyfriend.co.za. And before I give a final thought on this, Herman, you want to just chip in?
Yeah, it's just a small thing. Recently, I was speaking to a professor in... social care, social development. Yes, and she was in at a conference in Sweden relatively recently, and she said that the Scandinavian countries, if we refer to them earlier by their wonderful systems, an interesting thing happened there with a recent migrant influx. These societies who had state-driven solution infrastructure, they were caught with their pants down with these sudden problems, because government has been so effective for so long that the civic community really could outsource societal problem solving to the government. The wonderful, disguised blessing we have here in South Africa is that we have a vibrant civic society. We have networks of NGOs. We have a very strong toolkit with which to guide public debate and public policy. Absolutely. So with this NHI thing, it is incredibly depressing, and I think people should be depressed about it, but they shouldn't be complacent. We have things to do. We have these networks. People can get involved, and I think we all here would encourage them to do so. The more we can get involved in the civic, action, the more difficult it will become for government to do absolutely stupid things.
Absolutely. Fully agreed. Guys, let's move on slightly. Onto a topic which I think a lot of people will take. I always forget this word. Is it Schadenfreude?
Yeah, it's a sort of bitter pleasure.
And don't get me wrong, I take no pleasure out of this. it is something we've been saying for a while in terms of, the DA's, off of the DA's bad results in this last election, that the DA must learn from it, because if not, if they continue with the arrogance, if they continue with the, essentially the wishy-washiness of their messaging to the public, they're going to continue bleeding votes to other parties. And sure enough, recent by-election this week on Wednesday in the Northwest, is it, Sarah?
Yeah, it's Northwest.
And I'll open it to you, Sarah, on this one. They saw a spectacular loss to the Freedom Front Plus, didn't they?
Yeah. It was in Stilfontein, which I think the DA has held since about 1998. So whatever the DA may say about the constituency, it was loyal to the DA. The DA went from the previous vote, the previous election, to from 1,800 votes to less than 500. And the FF Plus virtually went the other way. It was a spectacular indictment of the DA. And obviously it's in an area that is very alert to what happened at Schweizer Reinecke with the teacher that was suspended, where the DA sort of went in where angels fear to tread, pronounced it racist, and then had to kind of back down on it. It could have been the ANC. You wouldn't have noticed the difference. Yeah. Mm. But it's that sort of thing. And it's not, the DA likes to say, these people are racist, we're well rid of them. It's absolutely relevant. These people are afraid. They're afraid, they're discomforted, and they're disillusioned.
Absolutely. Herman, I know you probably are chomping at the bit to have a say on this, but I want you to give us some analysis, because I've been saying, for example, for a while, that you cannot call your base without evidence racist, bigots, we're happy they left. And then when you lose 500,000 votes or nearly 500,000 votes in the last election, you then say, after criticism, of course, maybe we shouldn't have been saying those sort of things. And but still, that some racists did leave and blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, lack a self-awareness, a self-introspection, if you will, around why people feel as though they can't trust you as a brand anymore, as the DA.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The brand of the DA is, I think, a very complex thing to look at, because it has so many brands, not just historically going back to the progressives and so on, but even more recently. You have there was the alliance with the NNP that collapsed, the Independent Democrats. So the identity of the DA not only is a problem, it translates to a brand issue. But the one thing that the DA managed for at least 10 years, since 1999, was to have a relatively strong support base, which it was difficult to chip away from. And my personal theory is that one of the reasons that this support base was so strong and durable was the inevitability factor. There was this perception that, of course, the DA is going to grow in the next election. We might just as well support them. At some point in the future, they are going to become the government. Mm. And I think they managed, with that inevitability perception, to maintain electoral support for the past decade. But with the 2019 election, that inevitability perception is if not completely destroyed, significantly damaged. The idea that the DA, we could just as well fall behind them, they're going to be our future government, that's gone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why the DA did so terribly here. A lot of voters probably went, well, this isn't the future government I'm looking for. They're not going to be the future government by, you know, the default that we used to think. So I could choose other options and not damage a future governing party.
I mean, one of the interesting things about bleeding to the FF Plus is not anything about white conservative racism. I think more than anything, the FF Plus conveyed strength and certainty. Mm. And that's the complete opposite of what you're saying. The fact that the DA got resistance from people who have supported it ad infinitum suggests that something fundamental has gone wrong. Mm. And I'll give you an example close to home. My two kids, so they just graduated university, white boys. They have had the discomfort of trying to apply for jobs in which they've either been told, sorry, blacks only or affirmative action candidates preferred, or nothing is said, and then they get into the interview stage and they say, I'm sorry, it's got to be a black person. As one of them said, you know, they actually prefer them to be upfront about it because then you don't have to go through all that pain and frustration. And they are boys who've, The last couple of elections, they voted DA, and they said the fact that they do they ambiguously support the ANC idea of BEE, they don't represent me. Mm. That's it.
And if we're going to talk about strength, you might call it plagiarism. You might call it being, you know, not completely original, but the fact that the Freedom Front Plus took Slaan Terug as the election slogan, I mean, that was political brilliance. And politics isn't about subtlety.
Yes, no.
And that wasn't a subtle call at all. But 2 weeks before the election, here comes Tony Leon, here comes Helen Ziller campaigning via robocalls and so on. And that's just too late. By that time, the image of strength, of standing up against a government.
But it's worse than too late. It's basically saying our strength lies in people that we have essentially marginalized.
Yes. Yeah.
What could be a worse...
You voted for us when these guys were our leaders. Just remember that they were.
Yeah.
And, you know, Herman brings up a good point. Insofar as how the VF Plus, I think they saw the writing on the wall very early. And they capitalized, to their credit, by the way. I'm never one to criticize someone who's done something, you know, right, smart, so to speak. VF Plus quickly realized that very few political parties in opposition were actually offering something different, something actually that opposes, if you will, the hegemony. And the hegemony, by the way, to the average voter, wasn't just the ANC. There's so many iterations of the ANC now, either in extremes or watered-down versions, extremes being things like the EFF, for example. And sadly, I must say this, and pardon me if you take offense, whoever's listening, the DA, to a lesser extent, you know, appropriating the language of identity politics, for example. You know, how can you have a leader of a party, for example, who throws his wife, a white woman, under the bus by saying, oh, you know, she is a beneficiary of white privilege. I think anybody who was listening to that was saying, well, I'm not really seeing the quote-unquote clear blue water between the ANC and the DA. But here's this VF Plus saying something different, seemingly looking to fight for me on certain key issues, property rights, et cetera, I'll vote for them. Herman?
Yes, I mean, I absolutely agree. It's this looking for something different. And within the current climate, I think especially in terms of Brexit and Trump and the recent Australian election, there is a temptation to, you know, lumber onto the anti-establishment bandwagon and say, oh, we're in this anti-establishmentarianistic age. But if we're going to be completely honest, that's politics time immemorium. The DP in 1999, when it became the official opposition, ran as an anti-establishment party. And the Freedom Front Plus absolutely took that mantle 10 years later, or 20 years later, and ran with it. Voters are always looking to change the status quo because it's always the status quo that is the cause of the current problems.
I think the one way we can graphically describe it is, as my colleague Maria said in the television broadcast. Mm-hmm. Voters want to see testicular fortitude. EFF has it for all the wrong reasons. EFF Plus has it for some right, some wrong reasons.
Some very far right reasons. I'm kidding.
But the DA, it looks like it needs some testicular fortitude.
Yeah. And say what you want about someone like Helen Ziller. She was confrontational. But, you know, you taste the Marmite on the bread. Yeah. You don't taste the butter.
May I say something about that? Again, sort of a local anecdote, but I think it probably holds more widely than this. I have a char. He's a middle-aged man. He's from Northern KwaZulu-Natal. He's gay and he's illiterate. He gets all his news from SABC 123 and radio. About five elections ago, he changed from the ANC to the DA. He didn't like what the ANC was doing, didn't like where they were going. And he still loves Helen Ziller. Mm. And he loves Helen Ziller because whatever her faults may be, Helen had the fortitude that people are looking for.
Yeah.
And everyone else, as far as he's concerned, he's still supportive, but he sees them as pretty naff by comparison.
There's this... two quick anecdotes from my side. During the election campaign, I was working for the DA in the Western Cape. Please, listener, don't hold that against me. But on my way back to work, the one day I stopped at a petrol station, and the coloured lady who was the attendant there, she asked where I was coming from, and I said from work, and she's like, "Oh, this late?" I'm like, "Yeah, no, I'm." Just worked until now, and she asked me, "What do I do?" And I said, "Well, I work for the DA's election campaign." And then she said, "Oh, yes, she really wants Helen Ziller to be president." And it just struck me that we might be very much in tune to the political currencies and comings and goings, but the average South African, they have better things to worry about. Mm. They have kids to look after, they have salaries to earn, they have mortgages to pay, and one of the strengths that the DA had was that they had testicular fortitude to cut through the noise. And that reminds me of in the final chapter of Margaret Thatcher's second volume of her autobiography, The Path to Power. She tells how she went to, I think it was Poland, a community there, and the people told her that even through the propaganda loudspeaker, her voice cut through. Mm. So even through, you know, the distortions, people could hear strength of character, strength of conviction, strength of ideology. And I think Helen Ziller was very similar to that. Mm-hmm. I think there are people in the DA who can be that again, but you need that fortitude.
What's interesting, just a last point on this, is that what that anecdote reveals is, in fact, is that people can sort the debates about tweeting about colonialism and how good and bad a thing it was, and the issues.
Absolutely. Speaking about the issues and sorting through the debates, or in this case, a failure to even debate and resorting to violence, I'm going to shift it over to the EFF. This week in Parliament, we saw the EFF maybe take it up a notch from its usual, bluster and rhetoric to something a lot more threatening, a lot more menacing, and essentially fascistic in nature. And we were making this point early on, that like you had the brown shirts and the black shirts of yesteryear, you know, under Hitler and Mussolini respectively, we now as South Africans are facing a real threat of the red shirts, if you will, and the red berets. EFF in Parliament takes exception to Pravin Gordhan coming to deliver the budget speech. But instead of just, you know, sort of shouting him out as they historically did with Jacob Zuma, for example, they then do something we've never seen them do before, which is essentially mob the podium and rush, essentially even assail, you can call it, the speaker. And a lot of South Africans were left almost shocked by this. Now, we've always known the EFF, you know, are full of sort of rhetoric, but we've never sort of... And maybe this is my naivety coming through, and but we've never sort of assumed that they'll take on a violent predisposition towards something. I'm lying. I'm hearing it as I say it. We've always known that they're this.
A violent predisposition.
But I think they were, to see them do it in the House was something new. Let me put it that way. Herman, I'm going to start with you. Because I think anybody who watched that, watched them confront and almost try and it looked like they wanted to beat up the minister, Pravin Gordhan, it left a very bitter taste in the mouth of South Africans, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, bitter taste doesn't even begin to describe it. At least for those people who tasted it, there's one of my frustrations, or not frustrations, concerns about South Africa, is we have become blunted to the ridiculous behaviour of some of our parties. The ANC, you hear a story about the ANC being corrupt, you're like, oh well, that's a Wednesday, and you hear a story about the EFF being violent, you're like, oh, that's a Thursday, and then so they have managed, I don't know whether it's deliberately or how, but they have managed to make their form of absolute barbarity acceptable, or at least predictable and boring. So that's the one thing. So not all South Africans tasted it, but those who tasted it, it is upsetting to see the I don't know if it's called a progression, but to see the change from when you're talking about the colors of shirts, when the white shirts a few years ago stormed into the National Assembly chamber and with violence and a few fists, they threw out several members of parliament. I mean, as someone with a love of constitutional law and constitutional principles, that horrified me. I had literal sleepless nights about that. But there is a violence building in our politics that is upsetting, and I'm busy reading, and now this is going to sound terribly alarmist, but I'm busy reading the famous Scherer book about the rise and fall of the Third Reich. And it is fascinating to read about the tactics the early Nazi party used to disrupt public meetings of other parties, to interrupt speeches. And now, on the earlier 10 days or so ago, Malema said they will use violence to oppose violence.
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, that could be a quote from the early Workers' Party.
Mm. And I want to latch on to this, because I think when I say this online, people go, oh, there we go again, Big Daddy with the hyperbole. Boo-boo, this, you know, right-wing conservative propaganda. And I'm like, no, actually. If you could literally transplant what the brown shirts did and add some Malema and his cronies back in that time, and they would literally not be out of place. They'll literally be the same stuff. Insofar as, and by the way, we've seen this behavior in South Africa also manifest itself, because people say, yes, oh, but you never had the burning of books in South Africa, or the burning of things we don't like, or, you know, the trashing of space. I'm like, well, actually you have. Maybe not necessarily through the lens of the EFF or the brand of the EFF, but fees must fall.
Or the roads must fall. During Kudesa, for example.
We've had those same fascistic behaviors in this country, and we've never nipped them in the bud. And that's the problem, and that's what I think emboldens a more organized EFF around these sort of behaviors. And what makes it worse, and I'll come to you, Sarah, now, is that electorally speaking, you know, they probably look at it, oh, we grew in this election, we got more votes. So clearly this is an endorsement of this sort of behavior.
But I think the EFF may have overshot its mark or whatever at this point. I mean, that might be the positive way of looking at it. I remember watching, Sekle, your segment on the interview with people at the EFF launch before the election. I thought it was the most fascinating, A, because of what people said, and B, who said it. Generally, it was young people who were very clear what they wanted from a party that they voted for. And what they wanted was absolutely the same things that any of us wanted. The only difference was that they saw, rightly or wrongly, the EFF as the party that could produce it. They are not the people who are going to look at this behavior and say, oh, that's cool, another tactic that goes our way, you know, may get us closer to whatever. So I'm wondering, and it refers back to what you said, that they may have overplayed what their supporters will actually accept, because their supporters may not on a whole be as rabid as they are. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what you said earlier about the testicular fortitude. Up to now, they have shown that kind of fortitude, but this goes beyond that.
This shows an abuse. And my hobby horse is the fact that I remember when Julius Malema became the head of the Youth League, and he started to appear in the media disproportionately often compared to any previous Youth League leader. And I know he's sort of bold and different, but he hasn't got anything to say to us. He doesn't govern us. He doesn't represent any constituency particularly, other than the youth in the ANC. And he certainly doesn't represent a policy scenario. Mm. Why are people paying attention? And they paid more and more attention. And the media, the standard media, just actually got sucked into him in every possible way. Absolutely. When most of us could see that what was coming was fascistic.
Mm.
And now when you say, you know, the media was as responsible as anyone for making Julius Malema, they say, oh no, we're just reporting what we saw. Now we've got what we reported for.
Yeah. There's just one thing. I don't know if it's subliminal, but I try to be the voice of optimism. There is one thing I think we could definitely take away from this that latches onto what you're saying, Sarah, is the fact that most South Africans don't want punches being thrown. Mm. This is South Africa isn't Twitter.
Mm.
Twitter South Africa is so far removed from my day-to-day experiences with people of all races and all religions and so on, that generally there is a fundamental distaste for this kind of behavior and for the echo chamber that might go, oh yes, hashtag leadership. I don't think that translates to the average South African. I've yet to meet one person who fully endorses that.
Well, you'd be right. I mean, our polling shows this in the recent Hope report, you know, where we asked people, you know, do you think South Africans of all race and all class need each other for the country to succeed? You know, a whopping 80-something percent of people said absolutely, which bursts the myth that you find on social media that we're at loggerheads with each other, you know, where we're ready to bear a quote-unquote race war. But the one thing I just wanted to quickly raise on this is, you know, I find it very odd, if I can remember my point, but I find it very odd that, you know, we sort of entertain this because it entertains us, right? Like, it's really fun and funny to watch, you know, the sort of red-clad, almost Teletubby-looking guy sort of storming a minister, you know, like, oh, what's going to happen? You know, will you have Julius Malema's face as, like, the sun? sort of like this giggling baby sort of...
That poses the question, you know, what is tubby custard?
You know, like, I think we've come to make light of a behavior, and I think Julius knows this, right? He knows that there is a spectre of entertainment in it that sort of prevents people from going, yes, like, this is actually very scary.
He can't be serious.
And let me share a little story as to why I say this. This morning when I was driving into the studio, you know, I was listening to talk radio. Lord forbid I ever do that again. But, you know, they were discussing this topic and the callers were coming in, were saying, hey, man, I voted for the EFF because I believed in their seven cardinal sins and, I mean, was it cardinal pillars?
They're indistinguishable, to be honest.
You know, but what I saw yesterday scared me because it made me question whether I'd want someone like that or people like that in power. Mm. What happens if I, even their supporter, constructively disagree with them? Will I face a mob of red-clad people outside my house? Mm. And sorry, you were making a point about an established behavior like that already exists.
But you see, this is where I think they've shot their bolt to an extent, is that once Zuma had gone, the sort of theatrics had started to wear off and wear people down. And it became less, and partly because, you know, Zuma was so all-encompassing and so deserving of what he got that we did tolerate it. But at the moment, I mean, look, at the moment, no one, not Pravin Gordhan, not anyone, is in that league.
Yeah.
And I think most people's common sense is, what we want to see on TV is the boring aspect of our political parties getting down to business.
Oh, what we want to see on TV is Isidingo 7 lawn. We couldn't care. We don't want politics on our television.
We would rather go to that if it gets boring.
Yeah.
All right, guys. We're going to shift on to another topic. Something I think that also speaks to a much broader issue. Now, it's not just about this particular lady. Faith Mutambi, a woman who used to be a minister under the Zuma administration, relegated to the doldrums of parliament as a chairperson, is she not?
Well, she was just an MP, relegated to, you know, MP status. She, in other words, she wasn't put back in the cabinet.
Yeah. So she doesn't hold any office in parliament, like as a chairperson?
Now she does.
So, and obviously the ANC people see this as a demotion. The country saw it as a boon. To actually get rid of someone like that from cabinet. But now she's opened her mouth and basically criticized the private sector. Sorry, I'm looking to you. Mm-hmm. What did she say?
She said something at length, and so I have to confess I didn't read it all, but okay. because I stopped reading at the point where she laid at least equal blame on the business community for the ills of the society as it was being laid on the government. And it became very apparent very quickly that this woman that I think most of us would distrust deeply did not understand what the business community is, and that is not actually a community. It's just an all-round description of a very, very broad sector, that no one company represents any other company, that the guy who comes to fix my plumbing is not the same guy who's doing the finances at Anglo American. And the impression I got was that she conflated the idea of the business community with government, and more particularly with ANC government. And it was disturbing on a number of levels. One is because she's now in the position to say that and expect people to listen to her and take her seriously. And two is that she doesn't understand what she's talking about.
Mm. And that's my concern. I think your last statement is one which is reflective of the ANC period. Mm. They simply do not know what they're talking about when it comes to the economy, and you know, when it comes to those individuals, if you will, who are the innovators, the entrepreneurs, the ones who take the risk and build this economy that gives them, the politicians, the very sort of funds that they fleece from us. There's just a pure ignorance about how the economy works, and really about what needs to be done to foster it.
But there's also stasis that came out. I was listening to a business program the other day, and the guy talking was talking about the fact that, you know, one of the things a society desperately needs in the economy is to get rid of red tape, to make the creation and the promotion of business more fluid. Now, it's almost holy writ that's what we need. And apparently the last Minister of Small Business, Lindiwe Zulu, got onto that and had a commission or whatever they do and is producing a report. But nothing will be acted on, they've been told, until the end of this year. So we're looking at 3 years where I know I'm being a bit naive about it, but we're saying, just look at what's the red tape and get rid of it. Mm. But they were looking at what regulation, what legislation to put in place. And yes, I'm sure some things need legislation, but a hell of a lot of things don't.
Yeah.
Herman, a lot of things don't need regulation. Should we be, and this is part of the conversation we often have around the necessary reforms that are needed in the economy. We just do not need more politicians deciding more aspects of our lives and business.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we spoke about that earlier with the NHI and so on. The government giveth, the government taketh away, or the government tried to giveth, and the government faileth to doth anything sensibleth.
It taketh and it taketh away.
They taketh and they giveth to themselves.
Yeah,
but one of the things, ironically, I think that doesn't need regulation is Faith McTombie. This is disastrous, but it's wonderful. It is like Zinzi Mandela. It's just the removal of the makeup. It's just, you know, the aqueous cream or whatever elegantly removes makeup. You don't wear any, so you're just naturally beautiful. So I don't think.
So I have no comment.
Yeah, but this is, in a way, it's similar to the EFF, just, you know, losing it. Mm. This is good. This brings out into the open the blatant disconnect between some political classes and the average South African and the average investor who wants to invest in South Africa.
Complete lack of humility.
And let me bring something else in addition, because as I said, this conversation is broader, where you have these ideologues within the ANC, ideologues within the EFF, people who don't really understand much about anything other than the ideology, which is, you know, status, leftist, Leninist, socialist, blah, blah, blah. You go down the line. It's them versus the pragmatist. Mm. The individuals who, yes, maybe they were also immersed in that sort of leftism, but have grown up and matured enough to see that actually this nonsense doesn't work, and that you need something which strikes a middle ground that brings in more and more productive sectors of the economy and creates more productive individuals within the economy. I'm prefacing this way on purpose because Kgalema Mokente was in the news cycle this week, basically just reiterating the fact that, you know, guys, hey man, Kgalema Mokente, for those who don't know, was the deputy president and was president for a while. ANC chap, but he also says, hey man, look, EWC is just a road path to anarchy in this country. And, you know, he said this as someone who was at the helm of a commission, a whole commission on, you know, looking at the likely effects of land reform, or rather EWC on land reform, reiterates the point that he doesn't think EWC is a pathway this country should be taking with the sort of willy-nilly-ness that it's going on right now. In fact, period, it shouldn't happen. I'm looking to you, Herman, because I want us to have this brief conversation around, you know, the ideologues versus the pragmatist guys in the ANC.
Yeah. Let me preface my remarks on that issue by a bit of history, just a very short bit of history. And don't worry, I won't be going back to, you know, the Third Reich and all that. In 1971 or 72, Idi Amin kicked out all the Indians out of Uganda. And they were the business class. They were the hashtag white monopoly capital of Uganda in that time. And the data is, I mean, just fascinating. The majority of these Indians went to the UK, leaving behind basically their businesses, their bank accounts.
Well, they were told to leave in 7 days.
Yes.
And 7 days.
The clothes on their backs and basically what they could carry. And then you look at what happened, one, to Uganda, what happened to the Ugandan economy. It didn't go well.
Oh, it collapsed.
It collapsed utterly. And then on the other hand, what happened to these Indian families who went to the UK and Canada and Australia and so on? Within 10 years, they were back to middle class. Mm. They went from absolute poverty to middle class existence within a decade. Mm. So the thing there is, it's quite clear that they were not the problem. The private sector, if we go back to what Faith said, the ideology doesn't stack up to reality. If we look at what the business class, in that case the Indians, did, they were contributors to their community, and they showed that by becoming contributors in their new community. So there's this fundamental ideological blindness that people are just not willing to not even look at Western history, just look at our neighboring African countries, where governments have antagonized and victimized and targeted wealth creators and wealth contributors to society.
Mm. Can I just add two short points. Mm. The first is, I think it's incredibly sobering that what Lanti said was, one of the things he said was, society as we know it will disappear. Yes. Mm. if you don't protect property rights. And then the other thing is, where are all the stalwarts? They lined up and they showed their muscle and they showed their conviction when Zuma was robbing us blind. Did none of them think this is a problem? And that to me, there it goes. You know, we've all fallen back into line. And these are people, not everyone, but certainly there are people amongst them who will understand exactly what you've said.
And ironically, on this point of what Mohlante said, I was lucky enough to spend the day with the Youth Day with 40 or so people, and Thabo Mbeki as our guest of honor. And we started at the Voortrekker Monument, and then we went to Freedom Park. It was quite a fascinating day, and the day was ended off by this discussion with Thabo Mbeki. And part of the crowd were the 40 or 50 or 60 young people. Yes, I am young, ladies and gentlemen. part of the crowd, they were, of course, a few left-wing radicals on the land issue. And then they were quite antagonistic to Mbeki, and they said, what about the land issue? What about the land issue? And he turned to them and he said, do you want to be farmers? Anyone here, hands up who wants to be a farmer? Hands up who wants agricultural, you know, land to till and to wake, to have 28 hour days? He just absolutely just removed the carpet from their feet, and they collapsed onto this issue. The ideology, again, doesn't stack up. People like Mbeki know this, Mohlante know this, and even as the polling shows, the IR polling shows, the vast majority of South Africans know this.
Guys, final thoughts. I'm always fascinated I'm sticking to the EWC issue because, I'm someone who comes from a rural, well, half my family at least comes from a rural background in a place called Emaphumulo near Nkankla, Of all places, lol.
That's really
When you symbolic. Say rural, they weren't involved in anything there, you know? Like, I don't know. I heard there was a scandal in that part of the world.
You know, hey, man. We saw a palace suddenly.
suddenly around.
You know, the honest truth of the matter is, you know, when I left university, my first dream was to actually go back and start an agribusiness, you know, proper agribusiness. Why? Because my parents had saved, scrimped to get me through university, to get me that good education that allows an individual to sort of think differently and be an entrepreneurial and innovator. The problem became that when I rocked up to a piece of property that we've owned in the family for at least seven generations, as far back as the oral tradition can track. When I then tried to start this business by acquiring a little bit of capital, you know, to buy some capital equipment like tractors and blah, 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 you rock up to a bank and they say, no, actually, sorry, we can't. We love the business plan. We see it works. In fact, you've already started. So there is a bit of cashola coming in. But we can't give you this loan because you don't own this property. You don't have an asset that we can sort of leverage the risk to. And can I tell you that it immediately bursts any bubble that you have as a young innovator and a doer. Because you then think, oh, yikes, what should just take me 3 or 4, maybe 5 years to build a business would likely take 10, 15, simply because I don't have property rights. You know, I'd have to be dependent on a trickling in revenue in order to slowly build savings, and it would take forever. You then think about the lost opportunity. Like, I could have hired a lot of the people in this area so that they live beyond just a social grant, for example. You could have contributed towards the revenue base of smaller municipalities in the middle of nowhere. In this case, the Stanger municipality, or Watuguza, sorry. You then take a step back and you go, how many more young black South Africans are going through the same thing? Not because of some evil, quote-unquote, white person who owns the land and is, grinding the face of, almost that 1950s image of a capitalist, you know, a guy in a coat and a top hat, you know, grinding the face of the poor. It's not that individual who's in my way. Rather, it's government decisions, government policies that are in my way. In other words, a policy that says I'm not allowed to own land that we live on because it's owned by the Zulu king. And I'm essentially a renter, a lessee of land that we've lived on and call home. Property rights anchor any society. And I'm looking to you, Sarah, because I want you to chip in on this. If we don't get the property rights issue right, then you cannot build a property earning and a prosperous society.
You can't build such a society. And the other thing is, if you don't own land, you just essentially either live on it at somebody's behest or you rent it. You can't move, you can't sell it, which allows you then to move to an area where you think you can improve your lot. So people are destined to remain moribund. Mm. And every economic idea just fails.
I'm looking to you, Herman, because I wanted to talk to the broader topic here, which is, you know, We're seeing millions of black South Africans who live on former homelands and on these communal properties. When we look at them, we think, oh, but why are these people so poor? You know, they live on such vast tracts of land, often even some of the best
good land,
agricultural land in the country, but they're just doing nothing with it. And then you say to someone who's not initiated on this topic that actually, that individual who lives on that land can't invest in it. Like, it's not reasonable to expect them to invest in it, because a chief can come and say, oh, wonderful, you've got a feedlot here, you've got a dipping station and all of that. I'm taking this as, you know, part of the chieftaincy's land.
Yeah, no, it's... I might get crucified for saying this, but I think Africa, generally, is in a very unenvious position. We are going through a feudal system with the glare of a 21st century perspective. Europe went through the same evolution of philosophical ideas of ownership and economy, but they had the benefit of doing it in the dark ages, where when I don't think Twitter was as big as it is now. I think you literally had to throw a pigeon if you wanted to tweet something. But so we face a feudal system where you are a serf. If you're a poor black person in this country living on a third, I mean, the 2014 government audit, not that its data is very reliable, but even it states that about a third of the land in South Africa is in the control of tribal ownership. Mm. A third of South Africa is feudal. Mm. How can people develop individually for their children, for their own betterment, when
they're beholden,
they are serfs? Absolutely. When they have this lordship over them, and that's just it's fundamentally upsetting.
And it comes back to last gasp, the issue of give. Once you have a politician tell you that he or she earning something on your behalf is better for you than you earning it, or rather you making decisions about your life, that's where you start seeing the problems. And mm-hmm. land, property rights, and really when we speak about property rights, it's not just about land.
No.
It's also issues around, for example, your savings. Your savings are your property.
Yeah.
And there is a policy proposal by the ANC to go after even your pension now, core prescribed assets, mm-hmm. which we have. And let me just take a quick little asterisk moment here. You know, the Institute of Race Relations has a campaign that we're launching to essentially defend your right to own your pension and save it in the way in which you see fit. In other words, we're fighting back against the EWC, if you will, of pensions, which is a policy called prescribed assets. Look out for this on the Big Liberty Show. So, I'll be releasing an episode next week with Mike Schussler, economist Mike Schussler, where we discuss the dangers of prescribed assets and how it is essentially the nationalization of pension funds in this country. But the broader point, just to bring it back and tie it up, is to say that whenever you have a situation where politicians are beginning to control more and more aspects of your life, whether it's the decisions you make at the family, your property, your money, your education, you simply are left to the devices of someone who has no interest in you and doesn't even understand who you are. Whereas what we're advocating here is actually the individual, the family, be the one to make decisions around where they live, how they live, what education they access, what healthcare they access, and all these topics that we're looking at here today. And maybe on that basis, let me just thank my two colleagues for this wonderful show. Guys, thank you so much. Sarah Gunn, of course, who's the editor-in-chief of The Daily Friend, and Herman Pretorius, a new face here at the IRR, an intern and a writer who you can look forward to his stuff also going up on The Daily Friend. Guys, thank you for listening to the show. Remember, you can support The Daily Friend, both the show, the website, and all the work that we do here, by becoming a friend of the IRR. That's our crowdfunding campaign, which allows you to SMS your name to 32823. Terms and conditions to apply. An SMS will cost you 1 rand. And you can basically sign up to become one of our funders and donate 90 rand every month. If you don't like SMSs because you're thinking, yeah, I'm hip and cool, well, then find us online at irr.org.za/join. And you can sign up a monthly debit order of between 70 and 90 rand, as I said there. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. We will catch you next week on The Daily Friend.